On this episode of ITAV, what it means to be certified in the IT space, training your team on ransomware, and how AV can leverage AI. All that and more. Next on ITAV.
The network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
This is ITAV, episode 33, recorded Friday, August 23rd, 2019. Keep them separated.
Support for AV Nation is brought to you by Kramer, AV Beyond the Box.
This is ITAV, the monthly look at the IT and the AV industry and how the two of them come together. My name is Tim Albright. I am your host with us to discuss the information news that we have gathered for this month. First and foremost, his name is George Tucker, comes to us by way of Yonkers, New York. How are you, sir?
Very well. Thank you very much.
Staying in New York, his name is Derek Jonkus. He works for Extron, and he's just due north of Mr. Tucker. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Good to see you.
Good to see you, man. And last but not least, in my office, Mr. Michael Drainer from Drainer Technologies. Welcome, sir.
How are you all doing today? Glad to be in the Hickville Midwest with these big city slickers.
Well, Tucker's the only city slicker. Derek lives in where they, you know, they farm in New York as a big state. You know, they do farming and stuff.
What? Yeah. No, it's just a city.
No.
Hey, get out. That can't possibly be. Don't tell anybody.
Yeah. So first story here, and it seems a little redundant because we've covered this an awful lot, both on this show as well as on AV Week. But ransomware. This one is a little bit different, though. This past weekend in Keene, Texas, a ransomware hit the little sleepy town of Keene, Texas. It's a quote-unquote 40 miles north of south of Fort Worth, the population of 6,500. This hit, though, this ransomware attack on this municipality was one of several, and a lot of security experts are calling it a coordinated attack. From one central, well-organized organization. Who that organization is, we're not quite sure yet. That's the part that makes it a little bit cloak and daggerish. But this is something that we're getting into a spot when it comes to computers and networks and your employees and your networks that folks are starting to pull back some of the reins. Michael, we'll start with you on this. We talked a little bit before we started recording. All four of us are old enough to remember the days of mainframes. And for those of you who weren't in the workforce yet, you had a monitor and a keyboard, and everybody had one on their desk. And this was all tied back to one central system. And I'm being simplistic here because I wasn't involved then, so I don't know exactly how it worked. But generically, they all went back to one mainframe, one big computer. And you all kind of, you know, worked and flowed and did that data entry and pulled things from it. But that was your one location. You were able to secure that one location. A lot of times, at least when I started working, it wasn't even hooked to the internet, and it eventually got there. That moved to everybody had their own device, right? Everybody had their own PC, laptops, you know, and now everything that we have is online. And we're able to go virtually everywhere. Now security people are pulling back some of those freedoms, pulling back some of that, and having to put safeguards where some employees are hitting those safeguards by clicking certain things. So, Michael, are we getting to a point where security folks and IT folks and AV folks with their devices are going to have to start locking down where we can go with certain parts of the internet? And if so, how does that impact some of the systems we already have in place?
You're absolutely right. You know, what we were talking about previously was that we're seeing a regression in latitude, really, and an employee freedom to be able to browse and surf and go where they feel they need to go, whether for leisure or for work. And unfortunately, the advent of ransomware and the constant progression of ransomware, the reality that it works because people aren't putting the protections in place, are requiring security folks to really lock things down. So what we're doing is really a threefold approach. It's one, training the user base, which is a big task in and of itself. But two, also you know, we think about firewalls as protecting us from the outside world, but we're using firewalls today to also restrict outbound traffic so that if your user does click on something that they shouldn't click on, that it's not going to go to a country where you don't do business, right? So for international corporations, this is a little bit of a bigger issue, but if you read the article, these are small municipalities, 6,500 people. These are small town America that are getting hit, and 22 of them all at once. So having a good outbound security practice that keeps people from visiting Croatia and the Ukraine and Russia, there's really no reason for you to go there. And people don't do it on purpose, but they click the wrong link and it takes them to those malicious sites and downloads the malicious software. So we are seeing a restriction on where you can go. We're seeing companies lock down things like Facebook. If you want to go to Facebook, you go on your mobile device, not on our network, and you can access those resources. So yeah, we are seeing a regression where we started off in the late 90s and early 2000s of, you know, lockdown tight, this internet is this scary place that nobody really understands, to, hey, the whole world is open and free, go wherever you want. Now the actors have compromised that, and we're pulling back and saying, okay, no, we're going to start to restrict this, and even some companies to the point of only to what you need. And what this creates is a bit of an administration issue in IT services to be able to work with the business leaders to make sure that the people get what they need, all the while protecting the company's assets. And so it's this constant push and pull that we're starting to see again, like we had in the early 2000s and late 90s.
George, when it comes to making sure that, that your employees understand that the processes here and the reasonings behind it, how do we walk through and make sure that we're not breaking things, or the security folks aren't breaking things when it comes to pulling some of these freedoms back and this this open internet back? And then what's the process of explaining to security that, hey, yes, we do need this port open, and you know, kind of the back and forth and the negotiation tactics that, you know, both IT and AV folks can use to walk the process and understanding security, but also understanding that that we have devices that need certain ports open to get stuff done.
It's funny. I think it's very similar to the sort of sexual harassment training that we have people go through, right? And that's a mixed bag, because that's a standard procedure we've always done as IT-centric folks, is here are the things you don't do. Don't open a link from someone you don't know. If it's from a person you think you know, but it's referencing something obscure, don't click the link, because we don't know where it's from. You know, it really is simple things like that. But if you're talking from a corporate perspective, or from, say, a broadcast audiovisual perspective of that network hosting all of those essential services, you really are looking at a parallel network. You know, with Michael's point, what do we used to do with AV? We said, well, it's too much for the bandwidth of a single network, so we're going to have a parallel network. We really are getting back to the things, like he said, thin client, and where you're really not going to have that kind of control, or where you get the information you want via a public access, not the private internal network. And I really do think that's the only way around it. We can yelp all we want about training the user, training the user, training the employees, but you are going to always have something that gets around it, that somebody's going to do something they're not supposed to, so you have to keep it separated.
Well, let's face the facts. The actors are getting so good. Yeah. I mean, they are getting really good at crafting emails and websites that are extremely believable, where even seasoned professionals in technology are becoming victim to their attacks. So, you know, where we've been preaching as the AV industry, convergence, 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 as security folks, we're saying diverge, diverge, diverge.
Right, right.
So,
you know, like we got caught into this trap of it's an ease of use, that it's a single framework and everybody knows what's going on. And once the IT staff knows what that device is and what its packets are, everything's honky-dory. But the truth is, it's not. And things are getting mixed up in a way that there's too much to manage. And if you can't train the people well enough, and then you have to do it. You know, I just don't see that happening. It's like having teenage kids. I have them downstairs. They want to learn about how to do things, and especially on their computers. But they're on a separate VLAN in my house. Why? Because I know they're going to muck it up. They're going to try something. They're going to go somewhere. They're going to download a game that someone said to do. And at least I've got their section may get hurt, but nothing else does. All right. So I've kept it separate that way. and I've limited who can go where. I do this in the theaters. We do a captioning and audio description and streaming audio via an app on certain smartphones or smart devices. And always there's a question from the IT guys. What's inbound? What's outbound? How do I limit it? What are the packets? What are the ports, right? And that's our standard stuff. And you got to keep them separated. They put us in separate VLANs and they keep us away from the administrative so that none of that can happen. It's highly unlikely, but hey, why would you risk it?
Go ahead, Derek.
I was just going to say, I think it's just part of the accessibility, usability, security kind of argument. You know, take all three of those terms and pick two. Okay. Because I think what we've had, you know, we're all at our heart, I guess we're all, you know, technology folks, and we definitely enjoy seeing it deployed. You know, it's kind of some of our passions. And, but I think over time, what we've done is we've really developed, so we're on our way to developing more application specific networks. It used to be all about the connectivity and having the accessibility, but I think Michael and George, even you, Tim, are really describing us going back to things that are much more application specific, right? So if you want to transmit or transport video, this is the strategy that you use. These are the things you don't need access to. And along the same lines, I think you know, many of the technologies in the past, to go back to that mainframe reference, is that those were very application specific devices. You know, you were managing accounting systems, or you're managing the processing of some kind of payment, or the stand up of some kind of special service. And all of those things kind of, we kind of gone full circle, right? Give us access to the network. Getting things on the network used to be the hard thing. And I think I just read not too long ago that someone made the comment that it used to be very hard to make things public. Now it's very hard to make things private.
Oh my gosh, that is so true.
Dollar cost a long time ago, right? And that cost has shifted from, hey, I want everyone to know I'm here, I want a website. And now I want to be very careful about what it is that people can see about me and everything else, because it's so easy to make things public. It's almost that happens by default.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Next story comes to us from our friends over at AV Magazine. Sennheiser has announced that their TeamConnect Ceiling 2 microphone has been certified for Microsoft Teams. This is not necessarily about Sennheiser, although, you know, it's good for them. But this is more about Microsoft Teams and this move to, I'm not going to say rush to get things Microsoft certified, but certainly there is a push within the AV community. And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and I've written about it when it comes to the AV industry, specifically the manufacturers, making products and getting themselves certified in the UC space, in the unified communications and collaboration space. Extron, one of our underwriters, and Derek works for them, has a number of products that have been certified, not necessarily for Microsoft Teams, but in the UC space, right? Sennheiser obviously has as well. Other manufacturers are, you know, seeing this as an interesting space to work. Obviously, it's a profitable area for them to be in, and they are making products and pushing towards that. George, I want to start with you on this, though. When it comes to connecting ourselves, connecting anybody, right, manufacturer to an existing product or a ecosystem, I guess is the best way to put Teams right now, what are some of the hurdles and what are some of the benefits, honestly, of getting in on a system like this that Microsoft's pushing so heavily?
Well, there's a duality there, right? You're going to have the assurance that it works with this collaborative tool, and you'll be assured that it's optimized for that operation, which I think is great. And it does show clearly that the at least conference room AV is well-seated in the IT department, right? There's no clearer example of that. It's the first example of this microphone system is that it works with Microsoft Teams. You know, that instead of just, hey, you can get a great, you know, follow the speaker anywhere kind of the technology, its real selling point is that it's with a specific platform based on an IT collaborative tool, right? There's nothing clearer than that. So, but that the problem is, of course, that you can't transfer that technology to something else or to another room or to another application. Or if you can, it's not as guaranteed. And there's, you know, the pitfalls of what am I going to lose by not utilizing this certified tool? And I'm always sort of resistant, and my background is initially in AV over IT. I sort of merged over to the other side in that direction. is that I wanted that flexibility, and I want a tool that's a dedicated tool to its purpose of recording the sound, not tied to a platform. And that always bothers me. What happens in 2 years and I go to something instead like Zoom or whatever? Does it work with that? Or am I really going to have to rebuild again? Those are my main concerns in designing such a system.
Yeah. Derek, talk for a second. And I'm not going to ask you to reveal anything or break any contracts, but talk up for a second about working with, let's just say, other manufacturers, right? Who are in the UC space. What is it that they're looking for from you guys as far as, you know, making sure that you guys are you know, dotting all your I's and crossing all your T's to get certain certifications?
Yeah, there's, first, one thing it takes is really, if you think it's challenging enough making products on your own, try doing it with someone else, with all of their folks as well. I can tell you that it's been very educational for us, but I think it's also been very rewarding to find folks that are, who are like-minded and that are interested in, kind of working towards some common goals. And, I would say, one of the things that we like to do at Extron is really build relationships and just, being able to share some information or just be able to learn if the things that you're seeing in terms of trends are the same trends that are being seen by others is helpful when you're working with other manufacturers or other technology providers. So whether it's someone like Microsoft or whether it's something like for us, who's a little more hardware centric like Logitech, those folks all have their own goals and some of their own product plans. And to answer your question, what are they looking for from Extron? Well, I think for companies in our industry like Extron, we have a lot of experience deploying these systems and these applications that are probably a little more diverse than what some of those products that are in the UC space are really focused on providing. And, all of the providers, whether you're using Zoom or using, a product from that might be underpinnings of Dolby or something else, you're all trying to be able to support, what those mutual customers you may have, what their needs might be. And so the first thing they're looking for is some level of scalability. I think for us, control and automation really is a helpful aid. There's all different types of signal extension. There's ways to make rooms bigger and smaller, and that doesn't necessarily mean the physical space, but that could be the application complexity. And those are just some of our goals. Those are some of the things that we've been pursuing and have been talking about for quite some time.
Michael, bring it around to the IT manager when it comes to looking at these systems. What to them does Microsoft Teams certified or any sort of UC platform, what does it mean to be certified if you're looking at various pieces of hardware?
Really, from an administrative standpoint, it's all about having that support structure in place. As IT administrators, the teams, not the Microsoft Teams, but the staff teams in our organizations can't be experts on everything. And so these certifications are important because it lets them rest assured that the products that the AV team is specifying are designed to work within the ecosystem that they've already strategically chosen corporate-wide. And that makes it much more comforting to know that there's someone to, let's just be frank, point the finger at when these things don't work. Microsoft has already done the vetting of the device. They've already walked through that certification process and made sure that it plays nice in their world. And so it allows the AV guys to gain a little bit of trust with the IT team when they're specifying devices that do achieve those certification statuses.
Very good. Final story here goes to the New York Times and a really ginormous computer chip. Quote unquote, the largest computer chips would usually fit in the palm of your hand. Some could rest on the tip of your finger. Conventional wisdom says bigger would be a problem. However, a Silicon Valley startup called Cerebus is challenging that notion. On Monday, they unveiled what it claims to be the largest computer chip ever built for AI, artificial intelligence. And where I want to start with this, or go with this. It's a fascinating story, and you should read about the chip. But Derek, I want to start with you on this as the resident manufacturer here. Where are we when it comes to AI and AV and how that impacts IT?
We're probably some years behind where the rest of the IT world is, to be quite frank. I mean, in the AV business itself, we tend to have in our, I believe in our business, we tend to have our customers, we ingest some of these new technologies a little bit slower as an industry. When it comes to things like AI, and I think one of the challenging things about AI is, so you can do some AI, you can learn things about how people might be using systems, how they might be using spaces. But the biggest thing is, what do you do with all the information once you have it? Like, what's the actionable item? And I think that's the part of AI that seems to, you know, tick all the boxes for everybody is, and I think this is what the article also kind of, you know, the reason why the manufacturer is hedging against, you know, the size matters chips, right? Is that they are, they're hopeful to be able to consolidate that so that transactional, you know, analysis of information can be done, you know, much more quickly, much more consolidated fashion. And as an industry, I don't know that we have a place to put all that information yet to make it 100% actionable. I know that there are a lot of companies working on things like that, Exxon included, but there are lots of things that, you know, need to be in place in order for that to become very valuable, actionable information for customers. It's really all about their goals, right? Because information for the sake of information, you know, you can get a lot of information just by, you know, having a pencil and a notebook and standing outside a room or a space, but that's not really, really efficient. When it comes to AV systems, I think some of that has yet to play out from my perspective.
Well, let me ask you, because you said, you know, we have a lot of information. Is it something where it would be useful for manufacturers to come together in a, let's call it a consortium, because I don't have a better word for it.
Yeah.
And kind of work towards a common good, a common goal. Obviously, keeping their own stuff, you know, behind some closed doors, but also working together to, you know, get all this information and figure out something to do with it. Or is it better served where everybody kind of takes it to their own corner and works on it themselves, and then they figure it out? And obviously, if they figure it out first, or what to do, they're going to reap the benefits of it.
I think being open is helpful. I think that's a strategy that we've been pursuing in Extron to the extent that we can preserve the sanctity and security of the customer's information and their user experience, but at the same time be able to provide pathways so that these systems that we have, that natively AV systems generate a lot of data, a lot of things happen, button pushes, transactions, meetings start, they stop. I think there's a lot of value, and I think you'll see in our industry over the next year, you'll definitely see some announcements about how that kind of information can be shared. I'm aware of a number of organizations who are pursuing that strategy.
Very cool. Michael, you were the first person to show me EADS. And if you're not familiar with EADS, it's a computer program that lets you design the acoustical space of a room. And I'm simplifying it. Don't yell at me. Michael can correct me when I'm wrong here. Is that a first step, right? Computer systems like that, where you're bringing in the room measurements through a microphone, right? And you're showing a computer program what a space looks like. It spits back and tells you, okay, well, this is where you need to put the speakers, right? And I understand that it's a simplified version. It's not AI. It's not thinking. It's not doing something. But it's a step there. Are we going down a road yet where you can put a computer in the middle of a room with a microphone and push a button and just let the system, and maybe even a camera, and let the system design the space both acoustically and visually?
Thanks for taking my patent idea.
Somebody already has it. I'm telling you right now. I don't know anything. I haven't signed anything. Don't yell at me. But I'm telling you, somebody's already doing it.
So here's the thing. I mean, that's the nature of the logical progression of AI, in my opinion, is that we are going to get to a point where a lot of these analytical decisions are being made through artificial intelligence and not through the human ear. Now, in this particular instance that you specified here, there's still a lot of art that goes into that type of analysis. And, you know, you've got the scientific analytical piece of it, and then you have the artistic piece that says, yeah, you know, I know what the system is saying, but this is what feels right in this situation. And there is a lot of that, especially in the audio world. Video tends to be a little bit more absolute, but the audio world is a very, very subjective place. So I do see that our industry could get to a place where AI is making some decisions, but like Derek said, it takes a tremendous amount of data to be able to come up with, to teach a machine to make those decisions. And is there enough information out there to teach an artificial, intelligent, non-sentient being to be able to go down this road, right? So I guess what I said really isn't fair about video. There's a lot of subjectiveness that goes into video as well as to what is bright enough versus what's measured, what's actually needed for this space. Can we teach machines to do that? Maybe. But I'm with Derek. We're a ways out on that. I think we're a little bit closer to analyzing usage data, how things are consumed, how spaces are used, and then being able to make determinations with AI on how best to allocate resources. I think that's probably a logical step in where the industry is going. But we're quite a ways out yet in being able to artificially create the artistic side of AV.
All right, Mr. Tucker, you have the hardest job here. How long are we out from having the first AI AV person?
Interesting. I didn't think that's where you were going with that question. I was about to answer you and say it depends on what application you're speaking of.
That's a fine
right.
answer.
So AI, as used, say, by a tool I use for recognizing speech patterns and matching that to a script for a play so that you can put up captions as the actor, whoever that actor is, says them. That's now. And that's replacing a lot of technologies in which people would do it live, cart machines, that kind of thing, the closed captioning systems that they use out there. As to designing a room, as Michael was describing, I think you could say it's partly now, but to fully design one and implement it, I think you're looking at something like 5 to 10 years, 5 for a practical implication and 10 years for something where it's standard. Yeah. There's a great podcast out there from the EE Times magazine. EE Times has its own podcast, and they discuss AI and the development of logical programming systems in that nature. And they're looking at a 10-year plan of being able to utilize this stuff where it's designing the chips, testing the chips, and implementing the manufacturing of those chips or processes. So if that's true, then we're about a 5 to 10 year out of it being implemented within our world. I mean, as you said, it already is in many ways. Look at a predictive limiter in the audio world, right? It has look ahead, right? That kind of technology. We have that kind of stuff in programming that we use in the Meraki systems, for which are designed for retail, really, identifying where people are, what they're doing in their interactions, and then predicting what they might want to see or be guided towards in a retail environment. Same in theater. So, you know, it's there. It's what we do. It's just not fully implemented. And 10 years is, it's a long time. And that's a lot of development. And I think we'd be quite surprised by what it's going to really insinuate itself into over that time period.
Well, I think it's an important differentiator, too, to identify what is just a really good analytical algorithm and what is truly artificial intelligence. Because I think those lines are getting blurred today as to what is AI versus, and that was a perfect example, George, the difference between a look-ahead limiter, which is just using an algorithm to measure RMS levels and patterns, versus that of some sort of predictive intelligence on user interaction with the retail space, right? Those are two very different things, but the industry as a whole is kind of skewing those lines.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. All right, guys, that'll be it for us for this month. Thank you all so much. Mr. Derek Jonkis, thank you, sir.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. How do people find you and or Extron?
Contact me on LinkedIn, or you can email me at Extron, djonkis@extron.com.
Right, very good. Mr. George Tucker, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for having me on. I am available on the Twitter's Tucker2s, and keep an eye out. Some new podcasting news coming shortly. Probably.
Yay. Yay, very cool. Last but not least, Mr. Michael Drainer, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
How do people get a hold of you or DTI?
You can find me at Michael Drainer on Twitter, DTI at DrainerTech.com. Also hit me up on LinkedIn.
All right, very good. For me, for Tim Albright, don't follow me on the Twitters, but go by the website. If you would, please, avnation.tv. That's avnation.tv. You'll find this program and a host of others while you're there. Check out our supporter section. These folks who help us financially help us bring you ITAV and AV Week and all the others. And Exxon is one of those, so we thank them for their support. Also, check out our next webinar comes your way the middle of September. We're talking about UCC design and deployment. Things we talked about here. So all that and more at avnation.tv. That's avnation.tv. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you so much for watching. That's all the time we have for ITAV.